Okay, I think we're good. Good evening, everyone. So we'll start with a review. Before we do that, I want to say that this is the first time since we have started that I am skipping material because it's all about sacrifices and tithes and body parts. And I didn't really think there was much in it. So if there's a huge groundswell to bring it back, I will do so. But if not, we'll move on. And we'll start with the review, as we always do. So when we last met, we talked about whether slaves can be designated as property in order to collect debts from heirs. And it was a dispute between Ulla and Rabbi Nachman. And the dispute was really over whether slaves have the same status as land. And that led into a general discussion of acquisition. So to acquire things, and we've talked about it a couple of times, for slaves and for movable goods, they are acquired through the process of acquisition, which means moving them, lifting them, etc. You can't do that with land. And the Mishnah says that land is acquired through either money, contract, or possession. Then we got into a involved baraita discussing slaves, land, and movable goods. And they were paired together in each possible way. So there were three total pairings. And the question was, are slaves like land? Meaning you cannot acquire them together, or are slaves like movable goods, meaning you can acquire them together. And the last piece was, we got into the Mishnah again about the part of the Mishnah, which we will talk about all through tonight, about excluding things that are not liable for damages. And the first category we got to was Me'ilah, which is translated as sacrilege. It's sacred objects, objects that are the possession of the temple. And we learned that there are higher and lower forms of sacred property. And the difference is that with lower forms, you still own it. With higher forms, it belongs to the temple. So that's the review from last time. Any questions on that? Nope. So here's the Mishnah again. So the Mishnah was in three parts. This is part two. And there are five pieces to it. We talked about the first one now, property that does not have sacrilege. Now we will deal with, I feel like Jeopardy. We'll deal with property that belongs to members of the covenant. Property that is designated slash owned. We'll talk about that. Any place other than the special domain of the damager and the domain of the damaged and the damager. So once again, these are all things that are excluded from liability. So the way the Gemara is going to work, it's going to cite that line from the Mishnah that I just read, and then it'll go on to talk about it. Sometimes very briefly. So item number two, property that belongs to other members of the covenant. And you will see in the Hebrew, the term is B'nai Brit, just like the modern day B'nai Brith. So what does that exclude? And we get this kind of strange answer. If to exclude a Gentile, this is taught further on. And the citation is, an ox of an Israelite that gored the ox of a Gentile is exempt. Now, we get the strange thing that says taught and returns to explicate. So the Mishnah is saying that, seems to say, that Jews don't have to pay for damages to Gentiles. But if that is true, why does the Mishnah teach the same thing further on? And that's only on DAF 37. We're on DAF 13. So it's going to be a while. But if it teaches it there and it teaches it here, that's a repetition. And we all know that that is a big no-no in Talmud. So the general law is taught here, but later the Tana, the Mishnah, will elaborate. And that's why it says taught and returns to explicate. Basically, it will be taught later and we will come back and explain it in more detail. Now, I have highlighted the word Gentile, which in Hebrew is Oved Kochavim. And I want to do a slight digression about Gentiles. Especially in this day and age when we are all sensitive about what people are being called. So Gentile comes from the Latin gens, which means people. It's the root of the word genocide. And there's several different terms in the Talmud for this. Now, the Talmud was very heavily censored in the Middle Ages. There became a time when Christians went through all the Talmud and they were very sensitive that these words not refer to them. So they did substitution of different words. And these are kind of the words you see. So we all know the word goy. Goy means nation. It is not a pejorative term. It's used throughout the Torah. God says the Jews will be a goy gadol, a great nation. Only later, probably more modern times, that goyim became a pejorative term for non-Jews. But there's nothing wrong with it in those days. Now, the big word here is Ovdei Kochavim Umazalot, worshippers of stars and constellations. That is the term that the censors basically used. And it is, there's an acronym, I want to say it's acronymized, but that's not a good word. If you take the first letter of the three terms, you get the word Akum, which is a shorthand for that. Idol worshippers is just a general thing. You will notice the word mazalot, like mazal, mazal tov. Mazal actually means constellation or maybe even stars. So really, when you say mazal tov, you're saying my lucky stars. Another term that we find is nochri, which is another, I think it's a Bible word also, which means stranger. And rarely you will find the word notsri, which comes from Nazareth or Nazarite. And that generally means Christian. But again, you will not find that very often. So the bottom line here is it's almost impossible to tell who are non-Jews as opposed to idol worshipers, as opposed to heathens, as opposed to pagans. So do not be offended by any of these terms. We probably don't know originally what they all are. Let's just say it means pagans. Questions on that? Okay. So we did item two. Now we get to item three of the Mishnah. Nechasim hamichladim, property that is designated. Miyichudim has many different translations. I use designated. There is owned, assigned, singular. Biyachad means individually. So what does this mean? Rav Judah comes along and says, remember, these are all exclusions. So it's an exclusion where one says, your ox did the damage, and the other one says, your ox did the damage. Now, the Gemara is going to try and answer this, what this means in the next six slides. So we're going to get a lot of answers. But this first attempt is basically to say that this is a case where both parties insist that the other person's ox initiated the damage. It's like a car accident. He said, she said, and it's not always easy to know. But this is taught further on. We see a citation in blue. This is actually like we just had. There's going to be another Mishnah way down the line that will explain this. And it says, if two pursue one, this one says your ox did the damage, and the other one says your ox did the damage, they are both exempt. And once again, Taunton returns to exculpate means we will see it later on where it will be explained in more detail.
It's kind of like no fault insurance.
Very much so. And the only difference here in the later mission is going to be that two oxen of two men were chasing an animal, and we don't know who was the one that gored it. The next attempt.
But the person that's been damaged doesn't get any recompense.
No, it's the other way around, right? This is all about they have to pay for the damage they caused.
Right. But if they're both exempt from paying damage,
right?
Who pays the damage?
Nobody. It's a too bad situation.
So if Nagel's ox is chasing my ox through your field and we destroy your crop, you're just out because I say, no, his ox did it.
No, it's a different case. There, he would have to pay. This is where my ox and your ox presumably gore a third ox and neither of us can prove whose it was.
Right, so the owner of that third ox
is out of luck.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound very just, does it?
Well, is it just to make someone pay who's not responsible?
How few criminals really admit that they committed the crime?
I mean, you know, we have a lot of things about witnesses. But this continues. So this is attempt number three to explain it. So we have a baraita that says it comes to exclude ownerless property. The Hebrew word for ownerless is hefker, which is a big deal in the Talmud. We won't talk about it at all, but there are ways in which you make your property, you declare your property ownerless, and therefore you no longer have a liability for it. So what are we talking about? What is the case? Well,
that's true in modern days. Divorcing husbands, at least they used to, put an ad in the paper that said, I will no longer be responsible for my wife's debts.
That is true, but I don't think the legal principle is exactly the same.
Well, ownerless property, you know, they're no longer she doesn't own his property anymore.
Well, and he doesn't own her, which is more important, but he never did. So what is the case? If we say that one of our oxen gored an ownerless ox, who is going to sue him? Right? This is common sense. If the ox is ownerless, no one is there to collect from me. So maybe it's the other way around. Rather, an ownerless ox gored one of our oxen. So what if an ownerless ox gores my ox? What can I do? And the common sense is that seems to give me license to take that ox, the ownerless ox, as my damage, as my compensation. And what they're teaching here is when that happens, if somebody else takes the ox before me, then it really belongs to me. And that's what the Mishnah, that's why we need this Mishnah to teach us that lesson.
Are there really a lot of instances where there are ownerless oxen walking around?
I don't know, but
it wouldn't come up all that often, but okay.
Right, but you understand the way Talmud gets at law is it starts with a principle and then it says, and what if, and then what if, and then what if, and it expands it to kind of get to the root of the principle. So that's why we have an ownerless ox. And soon you will see we also, not soon, right here. This is, you get straight man points. There's another category, which is consecrated ox, where you technically don't own it either. So here we have answer number four with Ravina. So Ravina says, no, this is what's coming to teach us. An ox which is gored and afterwards was made consecrated, which is hekdesh, as opposed to hefker, which is the second part, an ox which is goring and afterwards was made ownerless. So what is he getting at here? Basically, this is like, nah, you can't catch me. the ox does damage, and then you declare it ownerless. So that you want to get out of the compensation. So we have a baraita, which comes from a midrash. It was also taught. Rav Judah said, even if it gored and afterwards was consecrated, or if it gored and afterwards was made ownerless, the owner is exempt, as it is said. And now we have a text, a proof text. We'll see that in a second. Had been foregone with its owner, it killed a man, unless the death and the standing before the court are alike. What does that mean? It's kind of cryptic. So let's go to, this is the actual text from the Torah. If the ox was wont to gore in time past, it's the dangerous ox, the muad, and warning has been given to its owner, and he has not kept it in, and it has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall also be put to death. Now, here's what Rav Judah is getting at. He is saying the two things in blue, the warning has been given to its owner, which he calls it's standing before the court, and it has killed. And what Rav Judah is saying is both of those things must be true in order to account. So if you give it a warning and then you declare it ownerless and then it kills, you're okay. But if not, then you are liable. So that if those things aren't both true, the owner would have no standing to have damages collected from him. That's his point. And the Gemara now wants to come and challenge this decision. And it says, but do we not require the verdict? Isn't the ox shall be stoned written in reference to the verdict? So what he's doing here is saying, not only are the two blue statements true, the green statement has to be true also. All three things must be true in order to assess damages. And that's why he says in the end, rather say, unless the death and the standing trial and the verdict are the same, meaning the owner has the same status through all three things. And you will notice that the Gemara here is actually rewriting the Baraita, because before it said the owner must be the same person for the warning and for the death, and now it says the warning, the death, and the stoning. And with that, we come to an end of the discussion of ownerless property.
So, Steve, one quick question to Lawrence's point. Back to Lawrence's point.
Yes.
The unowned ox.
Right.
We're going back to early Judaism. We didn't have like identification tags to put in ears and stuff like that. And I'm sure you didn't put a collar around an ox. So to go back to Stu's point, if my ox and his ox get into it and gore a third ox, and I deny that that's my ox, does that make it an ownerless ox?
No, it makes it an unknown ox. So that was the specific case we had in the Baraita, which meant if you both point the finger at each other, then neither of you are liable.
But what if I walk away and I deny? I know this sounds piddly, but if I know that my ox gored your ox and Stu's ox was right behind it and it was my fault and I walk away and there's no proof, it's kind of like, hitting the car in the parking lot and leaving.
Yeah. Do you get away with the crime? The answer is yes. Unless, of course, if there are witnesses, then you're going to be liable and fined with some kind of a penalty.
True. And yes. I would never not admit to goring your ox if my ox did. I just want to make that clear.
Well, but you said Stu's there, so I could see that changing.
He'd been it on me in a heartbeat.
He'd dime you out right away.
Snitches get stitches.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. This is number 4 clause of the Mishnah, except in a place designated for the damager. If the damages are done on the property of the damaging ox's owner, the injured party cannot collect. Why? Because you can say to him, what was your ox doing on my property? He's trespassing. So you can't, he can't collect any damages from you. And that's it. That's it for clause four. Kind of commonsensical. Now comes the last one. And this will become, I don't want to say confusing, but a little unclear. So the last part says, V'reshut hanizak v'hamazik, and the domain of the damaged and the damager. Now, Rav Chisda said in the name of Avimi, in a jointly owned courtyard, there is liability for tooth and foot. So I hope you remember back to those categories of damages from a year ago. These are three, there are three things of the ox. There's tooth, foot, and horn. These are different ways of causing damage. At any rate, and this is what he says. So this is now the continuation of it. With the exception of a domain owned by the damager where he is exempt, a domain of the damager and the damaged, when it causes damage, the damager is liable.
Now, say that 10 times fast.
Pardon me?
Say that 10 times fast.
Right. So this is unclear. And what's unclear about it is, and I tried to show this with the colors, the green and the purple, is the purple sentence following the green sentence, or are they two independent sentences? And we'll see this a little more, so don't feel like you have to grab it all here. So this is not clear. And that means, you guessed it, a rabbinical dispute. So in the first corner, we have Rav Chisda. And what Rav Chisda is saying is that if the domain is owned jointly by the damager and the damaged, or if you want the plaintiff and the defendant is liable for damages done in the case of tooth and foot. All right, so that's where we stand for the moment. And now we have the opponent of Rav Chisda in the other corner, Rav Elazar. And he says the opposite. He is exempt for tooth and foot. And now he reads that sentence differently than you saw it before. And in the next slide, I'm gonna do a side-by-side so you'll see the difference. In fact, well, I'll say it here. So with the exception of a domain owned by the damager or a domain of the damager and the damage, see, he's putting those two sentences together. He is exempt. But when he causes damage, the damager is liable, and it includes horn. That's the third type of category. So here's what we have together. And I don't know that reading it together is going to help anymore. So just kind of stare at it for a moment. But what you'll see is in the second sentence for Rav Chisda, he says where he is exempt, just for the first part. And in the Rav Elazar version, the two sentences go together and he says where he is also exempt. Basically, do we have two independent clauses or do we have two clauses connected by the word or? And of course, depending on which authority you go with leads to who and what is your liability here. So, give an example. If it's your property alone, if you own it all by yourself, you would not have liability for damages. But if you co-own the property, then you have to reimburse your partner, which makes common sense. It's a little hard to get out of this, but you can understand it. So that's difference number one about the liability. The second difference is Rav Chisda says the damager is liable for tooth and foot. And Rav Elazar says the damager is liable for tooth and foot, but exempt for horn. So those are the two differences. Now, of course, we're going to spend some time on this. So this is good for Shmuel. Why is it good for Shmuel? Because if you go all the way back when we learned about the ox and the mave, the crop-destroying beast, it referred to trampling and eating, which we're calling tooth and foot. So therefore, Shmuel can interpret the last clause where it says the damager is liable to include horn. Therefore, Shmuel can include all three types of damage for liability. But according to Rav, who says the Mishnah taught ox, which includes all types of ox, then what are we talking about? So again, what the Gemara wants to do here is reconcile those two statements. If we're Shmuel, then we account for two of the three types of damages. I just misspoke a moment ago. I said all three, but only two. But according to Rav, Rav says ox means all three types of damages. So we have a contradiction. And how do we resolve that? And that's what the Gemara wants to do. Or according to Rav, since we already know all the damage information, why then do we need this Mishnah? What does it come to teach us that we didn't know already? And the answer is, it includes that which our rabbis have taught. So there's a baraita, and we had, again, the statement in the Mishnah, whenever damage has occurred, the damager is liable. And what this comes to say is it's talking about the four types of watchers that we spoke about at great length. The unpaid watcher, the borrower, the paid watcher, and the renter. So that's what the Mishnah is really coming to teach us here. And if the animal causes damage on their watch, they are liable. Now, this we know, the part two here, the tom, the ox that has never gored before, the innocent ox, pays half damages, and the muad, the dangerous ox, pays full damages. But now he comes to add something new. If the ox breaks out at night, or the robbers take it, but you break in, they open the fence up, and then the ox goes out and does damage, then what this is coming to teach us is the owner is exempt for this. because he is the guardian, which was just stated, of one type or another, and he's exempt because he has watched over it properly, right? He's only liable if he hasn't watched over it correctly. Now, the Gemara comes and wants to analyze this. So the master said, whenever damage has occurred, the damager is liable. And again, that means the four types of guardians. What are we talking about? If you say the ox of the lender damaged the ox of the borrower, let us say to him, if my ox had damaged someone else's, you would have to pay. Now that my ox has damaged your ox, should I have to pay? So if the lender's ox damages the borrower's ox, why should the lender have to pay? It's obvious he's not obligated. For the lender wouldn't have to pay even if his ox damaged someone else's ox, because the borrower, the guardian, is responsible for those damages. So maybe it's the other way around. The ox of the borrower damaged the ox of the lender. He could say to him, if my ox had been damaged by someone else, you would surely have had to pay me the full value. Now that damage has resulted, how can you offer me half damages? This is confusing again. So you'll be happy to know, Steve, that I have an audiovisual aid. So here's the case, what we're talking about. We have the lender and the borrower, and The animals are in the domain of the borrower. Now, the borrower is responsible for the lender's ox, right? Remember, he's a guardian. So in case number one, the lender's ox hurts the borrower's ox, the lender is not liable because the borrower is responsible for watching it. The other case is the opposite, where the borrower's ox damages the lender's ox. So there, the borrower is liable because he's supposed to be watching the property of the lender. Now, normally, if his ox, the borrower's ox, was an innocent ox, he would only pay half damages. But the argument is being made here that because the borrower has additional responsibility now as a guardian, he pays full damages. Everyone get that? That's what they're playing with.
The graphics are lovely, by the way.
My wife really enjoyed my oxen.
Yeah, I think they're cute.
Yeah, such cute oxen. They wouldn't gore anybody.
Oh, it shows how worldly you are not in the ways of oxen.
Not only that, if the horns are so curved, I don't know how much damage they could do.
Now, what if there was a colander and they gored a colander?
Nothing will ever top that. Okay. In fact, the lender's ox damaged the borrower's ox. And what are we dealing with here? So the Talmud is now going all the way back to the first case. The lender's ox damaged the borrower's ox. That's the top picture. But in this case, the borrower explicitly said, while he will take responsibility for the damages done to the animal, he is not responsible for the damage that the animal does. Therefore, the lender owes the borrower for the damage that the animal did to his ox. Right? That's the argument that's being made here. In other words, the borrower only took the responsibility of watching the lender's ox against damage, not against him causing damage. Okay, we now move into DAF 14. So if all of that is true, we go back to the text again, which said, if it was broken at night or the robbers took it by force and went out and did damage, he is exempt. But if during the day, he is liable. Why? He did not take upon himself responsibility for guarding against damage. The problem with suggesting this context for the Baraita is that in this last clause, we learned that was the Seifa, as it's called, the Resha and the Seifa. The implication is if an animal breaks out during the day, the borrower is liable for the damage it causes. But if the borrower stipulates he's not responsible, then why should he be liable? This is what it says. It here now is the Baraita. If he has taken upon himself responsibility for damages, he is liable. So what the Talmud is doing right now, in the next sentence, if it broke out at night or robbers took it by force and it went out and did damage, he is exempt. So the Talmud now inserts another clause into the Baraita. It adds this new line, if it went out and did damage. So that the borrower will accept responsibility for the damage caused by the animal. Okay. Is this really so? A classic Talmudic answer. Did Rav Yosef not teach? Now, we're getting into, we have another Baraita coming in. And again, we're going to see a contradiction, which of course, by now you know, the Talmud does not like. So Rav Yosef came along and taught, and this is now going back again, a jointly owned courtyard or the inn, pay attention to the inn, He is liable for tooth and foot. Is this a refutation of Rabbi Elazar? So again, I'm going to summarize it in the slide after next, but we just learned he is exempt for tooth and foot. That was that was what Rabbi Elazar taught in a Baraita. Now Rav Yosef comes and seems to teach the exact opposite. Rav Elazar would answer you, do you really think so? Are there not disputing Baraitot, which is a good word? So he's saying, guess what? We have Baraita that disagree with each other. And Rabbi Elazar gets to teach whatever he wants to teach. He gets to pick which one makes sense for him. And now we bring in a Tosefta, for it was taught. So again, I'm always big on this. There are three sources of tradition that come into the Talmud. We now know the Mishnah, we've seen many times, and the Baraita, which we see in every other sentence. The third source are the Tosefta. Tosefta, again, means additions. The Tosefta are things that were left out of the Mishnah, but they weren't thrown out. They were put in a separate book. my teacher, Morty Schwartz, likes to say, these are like the bonus features on a DVD, right? The outtakes from a movie, they put it in, or the making of the so-and-so, and you can read it on the DVD. That's Tosefta. So we have a Tosefta that says, four general rules were taught by Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar with regard to damages. So ignore the question for a moment. We're going to look at the four rules. Any premises owned by the damaged party and not by the damager, he is liable for all. So we know that, right? We've learned that. For the damager, in other words, any premises owned by the damager but not by the damaged party, he is exempt for all. Those two are pretty simple. These get a little more complicated, but only because of the language. This and that, which means different kinds of domains, such as a jointly owned courtyard or valley. You are exempt for tooth and foot, for goring, biting, pushing, falling down, kicking. A tom pays half damages, a muad pays full damages. And then we get, again, its inverse. Not this and that, if it's not one of those two cases, such as premises that don't belong to either party, you are liable for all those things. And again, we have half damages and full damages. So these are the four rules of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. You will not be tested on them, but these are what they're going to cite now. And what we care about is the dueling baraitot. So here's the summary again. First, we had Rav Elazar said he is exempt for tooth and foot. Then we had Rav Yosef teach in a jointly owned courtyard in he is liable for tooth and foot. And now we just had this statement from these four rules that in a jointly owned courtyard or valley, he is exempt for tooth and foot. So that third one agrees with the first one. But one and two, he is exempt, he is liable, are clearly contradictory. So how are we going to resolve this? So the Talmud says, in any case, it is taught, we have a Baraita, that the case of a domain jointly owned by both or a valley, you are exempt for tooth and foot. So the Baraita is saying, number one, Rav Elazar is right. And now the Talmud notices. These two contradict each other. Kasha. Some of you who know Yiddish might know the word kasha or kushya, right? It means a difficulty here. So, of course, we can't live with a contradiction. We got to try and resolve it. So now they're going to look carefully at the statements and see if they can find differences. And it does this in a typical way. It throws in a new third factor, to make a further differentiation. So you thought we were talking about this, but we're really talking about that. And here's the first go at it. So in a courtyard set aside by this one and that one for both fruits and oxen. So Rabbi Joseph says the courtyard is set aside for fruits, but not set aside for oxen. And that's the difference that they're trying to make. In other words, the Braita says you're exempt for tooth and foot in a domain in which both parties agree to allow food and cattle. So if an ox eats the food, the owner's not liable because you agreed. But Rabbi Joseph comes and says the owner is liable because a courtyard can be set aside for fruit, but not set aside for oxen. Therefore, the oxen shouldn't have been there. And if it tramples or eats the fruit, the owner is liable. And that's why they say with respect to tooth, such is considered the courtyard of the damaged party. But what you notice here is they threw in something that we weren't talking about, what's in the courtyard. Now the Talmud wants to teach you that we could have learned this just from the language of the Talmud. And you get this kind of cryptical, also precise, it teaches here, which is again the word for word translation. But this is one of these Talmud terms, Dekan Nami Katani. And that means this formula introduces a proof from the particular wording of the text. And how do they get away with that? So here's where they use the word in. So similar to an inn, and therefore it teaches similar to a valley. What are they talking about? If you go back to this statement, number two, jointly owned courtyard or the inn. Now, we never had inn before. That's new. So they're coming along and saying inn teaches us something specific, that in an inn, it's not acceptable to bring cattle into the inn. But the other Baraita referred to a valley where it is certainly, cattle are gladly welcomed into a valley. So what you see here is the Talmud prefers not to have Baraitot that contradict each other. And by doing this kind of sleight of hand, they can claim they are not contradicting each other. One thing I will add in here is the word for in is pundak or fundak, which you see in the second word in the second line. And if you think that doesn't sound like a Hebrew word, you are correct. It is a Greek word. And I forget exactly what it means. It doesn't translate very well. And it turns out I work with a woman whose last name is Fondaco, which is Italian, and it means innkeeper. So it was a rare piece of Talmudic etymology I got to use in real life. Okay, last piece here. This is right next to the end. Rav Zever raised a difficulty and he says, since it was a set aside for fruits, how can that be? For we need, and it eats in another field and it does not. And do I have, no. Abaye said to him, since it is not set aside for cattle, we can call it another man's field. Here's what he's saying. If we go all the way back to the text from Exodus that we read before, which I hope is here. See how much you, no, it's not here. So I'll just have to go from the text. So the text in Exodus says, if it eats in another's field. And the objection here is that a courtyard is not another man's field. So we can't apply that logic here. And Abaye answers that since the cattle are not supposed to be brought into this domain, it is considered as if it is another man's field. In other words, another man's field is simply a code word for a place where you don't bring your animals. And finally, Rav Ahav Difti said the Ravina, let us say that just as the Baraitot do not dispute, so too the Amoraim do not dispute. In other words, now that we've reconciled the Baraitas by using the language and saying they're referring to different things, let's go back. We have a dispute between Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Elazar, and let's say they're also not in disagreement. Rav Elazar, who holds the owner is exempt, would say that this is true in a case where the courtyard is set aside for fruit, and he agrees with Rav Zera. He is not liable because he is not in another man's field. Rav Hizda, who holds that the owner is liable, would agree with the Baya. So with that, we harmonize the two of them and we come to an end. Any questions, that's comments, good. Alternate opinions?
No.
Okay.